Hello, you are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 19, The Struggle for the People's Government. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Last episode, we went over the immediate threats of counter-revolution in Petrograd and Moscow, and saw how and why the workers and soldiers in those cities were able to prevail, securing, at least for now, victory in the class struggle. In this episode, we will discuss to what ends these victories were put, that is, the formation of the revolutionary Soviet government. As it turns out, it was quite a knockdown struggle for Lenin, the Bolshevik Party, and the proletariat, but they will all emerge in the end stronger and more unified in purpose. But this will turn out to be only the first part of the story. The fight for a new revolutionary government is a tale of multiple struggles. In this episode, we will focus on the struggle to ensure the program of the Second Congress of Soviets of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies is not betrayed or otherwise thwarted. But after that, we have the peasant question. That is, how to incorporate the peasants into a new government led by the party of the proletariat, so that Soviet power really is synonymous with people's power. I had initially endeavored to make this one episode, but it is simply too much. This episode will be close to an hour as it is. Trying to cram in a whole second act just is not feasible. And besides, why rush? This is important history to explore, not only for the sake of understanding the realities of the challenges the masses of Russia faced at the time and how they were overcome, but also so that we can counter the false and exaggerated accusations of Bolshevik intransigence and lusting for power. That is certainly worth an extra episode, right? In any event, I have let the Bolsheviks soak in their victory for a while, but time and our narrative moves on. The nitty-gritty realities of governing leave little room for idealist aspirations, requiring instead a shrewd and at times unyielding political approach. Thank goodness for the proletariat of Russia, Comrade Lenin is up to the task. The first thing we need to do is wrap up the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets of Workers and Soldiers' Deputies. We last left off at the end of the opening session of the Congress in the early hours of the 26th. Soon, though, the question of what kind of government should be formed loomed large. Without a doubt, the central question to address was the demand for broad coalition of the various socialist parties. This demand came from many different quarters, including from right Bolsheviks and left SRs, as well as the Mensheviks and right SRs, who, for some reason, thought that by voluntarily abandoning the Congress on the 25th, they were still entitled to share power. At this point, the desires of the Mensheviks and SRs to impose compromise from a weakened position were a secondary concern to the Bolsheviks. What was a far bigger problem was that the left SRs, at least at first, rejected an exclusively Bolshevik government. The left SRs were the obvious allies to the Bolsheviks. They had provided crucial support in October thus far, and since they represented the poor and working peasantry, maintaining that alliance was a far more practical and strategic concern. The second session of the Congress of Soviets began at 9 p.m. on the 26th. Before addressing the question of coalition, however, a flood of decrees were adopted. Elimination of the death penalty at the front, the release of soldiers jailed for political crimes and other political prisoners, the arrest of Kerensky, and two decrees that, without a doubt, were the most important of the entire Congress, the decrees on peace and on land. I have included four of these decrees as supplementals, the aforementioned two on peace and land, but also two more on the press and worker control. I have some thoughts to share about them, but I will do so at the end of the episode. For now, no tangents. After the various decrees were adopted, the question of the new government composition was finally taken up. Kamenev presented the Bolshevik proposal, the Soviet Narodnikh Komissarov, or Sovnarkom, would be the interim government, effectively the new provisional government, until the Constituent Assembly was convened. And yes, at this point, the Bolsheviks are still committed to the Constituent Assembly. But we are not getting into that here. There is a whole episode coming on that soon, so don't you worry. The name Sovnarkom will be the first of many, many, many bureaucratic acronyms and compound names the Soviets will come up with. As a language, Russian is very beautiful and elegant, but it has a lot of really long words, and so colloquially, Russians love to shorten the names of institutions as much as possible. All I can say is, get used to it now. Anyway, the Sovnarkom would be composed of various Narodnye Komissariaty, or People's Commissariats, the equivalents of ministries in most parliamentary systems, or governmental departments if you are American. The heads of these commissariats would be the commissars, or ministers, or secretaries. The Sovnarkom would be subordinate to the new Tsik of the Congress. Crucially, the Sovnarkom that Kamenev, as chairman of the Tsik, proposed on behalf of the Bolsheviks was made up exclusively of Bolsheviks. The initial composition of the Sovnarkom was as follows. Council Chairman Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Commissar of Affairs of Nationalities Yosef Vissarionovich Stalin. Commissar of Foreign Affairs Lev Davidovich Trotsky. Commissar of the Interior Alexei Ivanovich Rykov. Commissar of Agriculture Vladimir Pavlovich Milyutin. Commissar of Labor, Alexander Gavrilovich Shlyapnikov. Commissars of Army and Navy Affairs, a committee of Vladimir Alexandrovich Avsienko Antonov, Nikolai Vasilievich Krylenko, and Pavel Yefimovich Dubienko. Commissar of Social Welfare, Alexandra Mikhailovna Kolontai. Commissar of Commerce and Industry, Viktor Pavlovich Nagin. Commissar of Education, Anatoly Vasilievich Lunacharsky. Commissar of Finance, Ivan Ivanovich Skvortsov-Stepanov. Commissar of Justice, Georgi Ippolitovich Lomov. Commissar of Food, Ivan Adolfovich Teodorovich. Commissar of Post and Telegraphy, Nikolai Pavlovich Glebov-Avilov. The post of Commissar of Railways was left vacant, in the hope of offering it in good faith in the upcoming Vikzhel negotiations. But, well, we will see by the end of the episode just how that worked out. Many in the Congress opposed an exclusively Bolshevik government, including the Menshevik Internationalists, the Left SRs, and even the right Bolsheviks like Kamenev, Zinoviev, Nagin, and Rykov. Speeches were made by representatives of a bloc of the United Social Democratic Internationalists and Menshevik Internationalists, and by a left SR named Vladimir Karelin, encouraging and at times demanding a socialist coalition government. But if the right Bolsheviks were amenable to compromise and coalition with the Mensheviks and right SRs, the left Bolsheviks, the Leninists, were very much not. Trotsky spoke out against coalition, arguing that bringing in the collaborationist parties would only undermine a workers' and peasants' government. He made it clear that the Bolsheviks were willing to work with any group or individuals in the government, but only provided that they were on board with the Congress's program and willing to support the Bolsheviks in the likely event of civil war. The Mensheviks and right SRs did not fit that bill. But I want to repeat something before moving on. Lenin and the left Bolsheviks were not refusing to share power with anyone else. They were refusing to water down their revolutionary program. Anyone who was sincere in their desire to work with the Bolsheviks within the new Soviet governing framework and supported the new workers' government was welcome. But the left Bolsheviks believed that compromising on principles was the fastest way for the revolution to be stifled, and so that was their red line they were unwilling to cross. After Trotsky spoke out against coalition, the turn came for a representative from the All-Russian Executive Committee of the Union of Railwaymen, best known in English by its Russian acronym, Vikshel. I mentioned last episode that Vikshel presented an early and serious challenge to the new Soviet government. Well, here it is. A representative of Vikshel read a telegram from the Union announcing that if a coalition government was not reached, the Union would shut down the railways, which was pretty much the same as shutting down the entire country, and would have cut off Petrograd and Moscow from the rest of the country. This immediately got the attention of everyone involved. But we should not make the mistake of taking this stance to mean that the working class was starting to abandon the Bolsheviks. Within Vikshel, just like in many unions and parties in many countries throughout history, there was a divide. The upper management and leadership was rather conservative, tending to side with the SRs and Mensheviks. The rank and file, on the other hand, were more militant. Proof of this comes from this very session of the Congress. After the Vikshel representative threatened a strike, two railway workers took the floor to denounce the union as, quote, a political corpse that no longer represented the sentiments of its constituents, end quote. So the union should not be treated as a monolith, nor should anyone assume that the railway workers as a whole were opposed to Bolshevik or Soviet power. This was far from the case. In the end, the Second Congress concluded by accepting the Bolshevik proposal for an entirely Bolshevik Sovnarkom. They also voted for a new Tsikh, with a composition of 62 Bolsheviks, 29 left SRs, 6 United Social Democratic Internationalists, 3 Ukrainian Socialists, and 1 SR Maximalist. This new Tsikh was chaired by Kamenev, and the Congress declared that the Tsikh could later be augmented to include peasant Soviets, army organizations, and the other political parties that had walked out on the first day of the Congress. With an impressive list of accomplishments, overthrowing the provisional government, forming a new government in the Sovnarkom, electing a new Tsikh, passing multiple popular decrees, and opening the door to cooperation with other political parties and groups on firmly revolutionary grounds, the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies came to a close the morning of the 27th of October. Before moving on, I want to take a quick beat to draw attention to the fact that, while on paper a functioning, formalized government has been created, in reality, the burgeoning Soviet government was a rather underwhelming sight to behold. The entire government was being built on a purely ad hoc basis, with everyone operating out of a few rooms in the Smolny Institute. The Commissariat of Finance was denoted by literally a handwritten sign hanging over a couch in one of the rooms. Stalin's Commissariat of Affairs of Nationalities was all of one half of a large table. Lenin assigned a 25-year-old man named Nikolai Petrovich Gorbunov as the secretary for the entire Sovnarkom on the recommendation of his own personal secretary and fellow comrade, Bonch Bruyevich. The thing was, Gorbunov had absolutely no experience as a secretary, and had to hunt down a typewriter, on which he would bang everything out using just 2 fingers, since he did not know how to type. Because of the lack of equipment and personnel, decrees and orders were handwritten in their first drafts, often in shorthand, with occasional grammar and spelling mistakes. I mention all this to drive home the thoroughly humble nature of this new government. These are not wealthy landlords and slaveholders descended from the colonial history of the New World, meeting to discuss how best to free themselves from the yoke of a transatlantic crown while still maintaining their own power rooted in slavery and land ownership. Nor is this a third estate of a kingdom in crisis, comprised of small landowners, well-off merchants, and wealthy artisans endeavoring to throw off the fetters of feudalism in order to gain access to the power of government, all while largely ignoring the mass of peasants across the land. The coming Russian Civil War will not be fought between loyalists to a crown on one side and an emergent bourgeoisie ready to burst asunder the shackles of monarchy on the other. Nor will it be fought by a slave-owning minority against a business and merchant class to decide which mode of production will emerge victorious, slavery or modern capitalism. No, these commissars are from working families from various nationalities across the empire. They are wearing old, worn, cheap suits and sleeping just a handful of hours each day. They are struggling to come up with paper and ink and typewriters, and are learning the business of governing 100% on the fly. The Russian Civil War will be fought by workers, soldiers, and poor peasants fighting against the combined remnants of a broken aristocracy and dislodged bourgeoisie, desperate to turn back the clock and reassert control. The ideals of the new workers' government are lofty, aiming to completely reshape society in a more just and equitable manner. Its leaders are diehard, dedicated revolutionaries drawn from the working class and oppressed nationalities of the Russian Empire, who have been working to achieve precisely this for decades. But you would not know it to look at them. The very serious business of governing is being performed by the sons and daughters of teachers, farmers, coal miners, and factory workers sprawled out on couches and tables. If you saw a group photo of this new government and did not know already, you would think you were looking at a group of factory workers dressed in their Sunday best. Anyway, just something to keep in mind as we go forward. I do not know about you all, but it never ceases to amaze me just how humble were the origins of the Soviet state. Anyway, getting back to it, the Second Congress concluded right around the time that the fighting we discussed last episode was starting to break out. With the Sovnarkom formed and a new Tsik elected, but lacking a cohesive vision for how to move forward, and with Vikzhel threatening a crippling strike, the impact of this fighting on the course of the formation of the government was about to be felt. On the 29th of October, Vikzhel invited all the major groups to participate in negotiations under the union's auspices in order to create an all-inclusive, homogeneous socialist government. They underscored the entirely voluntary and totally not coercive nature of their invitation by threatening a nationwide railway strike at midnight that very night, unless a truce was proclaimed in Petrograd and Moscow. The timing of all this is very important. Lenin and Trotsky were busy coordinating the military responses to first the Petrograd Junker movement, then the invasion by Krasnov's troops, and, of course, the fierce fighting between Soviet and Junker forces in Moscow. Because of all this, Lenin and Trotsky were absent when the Bolshevik Central Committee discussed the Vikzhel situation. This meant that the committee was quickly swayed by the rightists to enter into negotiations with the other parties. Seeing that Lenin and Trotsky were too preoccupied with the military attacks to defend themselves from political attacks, the Mensheviks and SRs began pushing for both of them to be excluded from the government altogether. The Mensheviks and SRs wanted those two as far away from state power as possible, and now was the most opportune time to make that demand. Kamenev, as the chair of the Tsik, issued a statement signaling that, while this demand was not going to be immediately granted, it was also not entirely out of the question. It appeared that if it would mean forming a coalition government and avoiding a civil war, some in the Bolshevik Central Committee and many in the Tsik would be open to excluding Lenin and Trotsky from the Sovnarkom. Which is kind of nuts if you think about it. I do not want to foster a great man mentality around Lenin, but at the same time, at this point, he really was seen as the champion of the people by the workers and soldiers of Petrograd. Trotsky was, at this point, one of Lenin's most vociferous supporters. The fact that Kamenev was so willing to exclude them from the government in the name of compromise gives us our first indication that the right wing of the Bolshevik Party was more than a little out of touch with the masses. The first of many indications, I might add. So the right wing of the Bolshevik Party is willing, maybe a little too willing, to form a coalition. What about the Mensheviks and right SRs? Well, they looked at the situation a bit differently. Remember, they had loudly prophesied that the Bolsheviks would not be capable of governing. So, as the Bolsheviks appeared to be backtracking and their government appeared to be on the brink of crushing military defeats, these parties asked, "Why should we compromise?" The Bolsheviks went against our advice and overthrew the government. triggering a backlash that was threatening to spiral out of control and into a civil war. And now they're asking for us to bail them out? No. Better to just let them reap what they have sown. Probably in just another day or two, the arrogant Bolsheviks will be overthrown, and then we, the more sensible-minded socialists, will be able to step into the void. To this end, the Menshevik Central Committee issued a resolution prohibiting negotiations with the Bolsheviks, calling on the Committee for Salvation to spearhead the creation of a new government without the Bolsheviks, and even calling for the Military Revolutionary Committee in Petrograd to surrender. When the Vikzhel talks began on the 29th, the Mensheviks and Right SRs felt rather confident in themselves, speaking openly in support of the Menshevik resolution, as well as insisting on the disarming of the workers, and even floating the idea that everything that had been done by the Second Congress, the resolutions passed, the newly elected Sikh, the Sovnarkom, all of it, be declared null and void. The Bolsheviks insisted that the workers would not support a government without them, and so a broad coalition was the way to go. To the credit of the Right Bolsheviks, they defended the Nutsikh and the Second Congress, and categorically rejected the demand to disarm the workers. They were adamant that doing so would leave the masses wide open to reprisals from Krasnov and Kerensky, and so was completely out of the question. Throughout these meetings, reports continued to roll in of the fighting happening in and around Petrograd and Moscow. The Bolshevik delegation insisted it would accept a coalition with the other right socialist parties, even going so far as to propose that Tsikh be re-elected and that the Sovnarkom be restructured so that there was a 40-40-20 split between the Bolsheviks, the Menshevik SR bloc, and the left SRs and various internationalist groups, respectively. All through the 30th, however, the Menshevik SR bloc refused any and all compromise, insisting the Bolsheviks must be excluded from the government, period. But then, Krasnov was defeated, and then pushed back to Gatchina, and then Kerensky fled, and Krasnov was arrested. And wouldn't you know it, all of a sudden, the Mensheviks started walking back their resolution from the 29th, that the Bolsheviks be excluded from the government, opting instead so graciously and magnanimously to endorse coalition with the Bolsheviks. The Vikzhel talks turned to the possibility of a new governing Provisional People's Council, which would include not only the Bolsheviks, Mensheviks, Right SRs, and Left SRs, but also representatives of the First Tsikh, the one elected back in June, dominated by the Mensheviks and Right SRs, the Petrograd and Moscow City Dumas, representatives of the Soviets of Peasants' Deputies, and Vikzhel. After several hours of arguments and debates, by the end of the 31st, it appeared as if an agreement was on the verge of being made, with new governmental posts to be split between the major parties, and a promise that Lenin and Trotsky would not be allowed to occupy any of them. So hopeful was everyone for the amenable conclusion to the negotiations that on the 1st of November, the paper of the Petrograd Soviet, Rabochi I Soldat, or Worker and Soldier, published an editorial in which it declared that the Bolsheviks had no interest in maintaining single-party domination in a new revolutionary government, and lauding the new coalition that seemed about to be formed. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. This show is 100% listener funded and always will be. Become a Patreon of the Sickle and the Hammer today. There are multiple tiers, each with their own bag of goodies, depending on what you sign up for. Best of all, early access to episodes starts at the Comrade tier for just $5 a month. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. If you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast service you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. By the end of talks on the 31st, it appeared to many that a deal was close to being struck. But there was a problem. The Bolshevik delegation to the Vikzhel talks, led by the right wing of the party, brought back terms to be ratified which were completely unacceptable to the rest of the party, both the left wing of the leadership and the rank and file. The Petersburg Committee of the party had solicited reports from district committees on the 29th, right before entering the Vikzhel talks, regarding sentiment toward the talks themselves and the idea of compromise with the other parties for the sake of a unified government. Overwhelmingly, although not exclusively, the reports indicated that the rank and file prioritized a government that would commit to the program adopted by the Second Congress over anything else, including coalition. The workers and soldiers of Petrograd were rather hostile toward the Mensheviks and Right SRs, and their fighting spirit was high. They were ready, willing, and eager to defend the gains they had made under the Second Congress. The Petersburg Committee had subsequently adopted a resolution wherein they reaffirmed the slogan, "All power to the Soviets," and the party's commitment to the program of the Second Congress, even if that meant no compromise with the right socialist parties. This provided a strong basis for Lenin when he began arguing on the 29th and 30th that any compromise that sacrificed the gains of the Second Congress would be a betrayal of the working masses of Petrograd and the soldiers. He was correctly articulating the sentiments which the masses themselves had expressed. The Petrograd Committee then held a meeting on the 1st of November, right as it seemed that the Vikzhel talks would yield results of a compromise that would water down the government. At this meeting, Lenin and Trotsky, now freed from dealing with the immediate military threat to the revolution, decried the position of the right wing for having led them to a place of almost selling out the revolutionary principles that had gotten them and the masses this far. Lenin in particular was furious, calling the actions of the Central Committee, which had acted under the influence of Kamenev, remember, treasonous for having even allowed the matter to get this bad. The right Bolsheviks shot back that without coalition and compromise, the Bolsheviks and the revolution would be doomed. They openly expressed doubt that the party could rule on its own. They worried that the state apparatus would require too much force and terror to fight the Mensheviks and SRs. But Lenin was adamant. Compromise on the principles of the Second Congress was unacceptable, period. The debate and arguments of this Petrograd committee meeting were long and loud and acrimonious, and were cut short so that many of those in attendance could move everything over to the Central Committee meeting that was beginning that evening. Once everyone was settled in at this new venue, everything continued as if there had been no interruption. Lenin and Trotsky still rejected any notes of compromise with the other parties. The right Bolsheviks in the Central Committee, the by now usual suspects of Kamenev and Rykov, but also Lunacharsky, and someone I do not believe I have mentioned yet, David Borisovich Ryazanov, still argued that compromise and coalition were necessary, otherwise the Bolsheviks would be so isolated that they would lose the ensuing civil war. Here we see again the impact of the fortunes of the military campaigns we discussed last time on the political sphere. Because on the 1st of November, Krasnov had been defeated and pushed back to Tsarskoye Selo, and would be arrested at Gatchina the next day, and the fighting in Moscow, while still fierce, was going well in the favor of the Soviets, such that it seemed not a matter of if, but when the Junkers there would be defeated. This influenced members of the Central Committee to affirm that the Bolshevik delegation to the Vikzhel talks had exceeded the mandate of the Central Committee's meeting on the 29th, and had brought back several provisions that were unacceptable. By the end of the meeting, the Central Committee voted on what to do the next day at the Vikzhel talks. They rejected a proposal by Lenin to abandon the talks altogether, but they did approve what amounted to an ultimatum, that the new revolutionary government must recognize the program of the Second Congress as inviolable, that this new government authority must rest with the newly elected Sikh, and any hybrid organs like the proposed Provisional People's Council were rejected wholesale. What was more, to drive home the point of the new position, Kamenev, who had been the voice of the Bolsheviks at the Vikzhel talks and was the chair of the Tsikh, was not charged with bringing this resolution to the Tsikh for approval. That task fell to a Bolshevik named Moisey Markovich Goldstein, known to history by his revolutionary pseudonym V. Volodarsky. The Tsikh meeting began late on the 1st into early the 2nd of November. And let me just say here, boy, these guys love midnight meetings, don't they? Anyway, Volodarsky's report and ultimatum was met by many with shock, dismay, anger, and the accusations of Bolshevik duplicity. A United Social Democratic Internationalist named Barazov condemned the Bolsheviks, accusing them of reneging on earlier commitments and threatening an exodus of the USDI group from the Tsikh. Vladimir Karelin, a left SR, proposed that an independent revolutionary parliament heavily oriented toward the Soviets be the new organ of government. This rankled the left Bolsheviks, who insisted that the Soviets themselves be the organ of governance and state power. After much heated debate and back and forth, Volodarsky's ultimatum was adopted by the Tsikh, with a few changes made at the behest of the left SRs. The left SRs, despite some lingering misgivings, and in recognition of the changes made, supported the new Bolshevik position because, while they still wanted a broad socialist coalition to govern, they recognized that such a coalition would have to include the Bolsheviks, and rejecting the new terms would endanger the whole project. And besides, the new Bolshevik position was not no coalition, but a welcome coalition along very well-defined terms that accepted the program of the Second Congress. Principled compromise. That was the new name of the game. But hold on. If you thought that was the end of the argument, I hate to disappoint you. Because while the Tsikh approved the new terms, when the terms went back to the Bolshevik Central Committee for debate and approval, which was necessary because of the minor changes made at the behest of the left SRs, it reopened the debate entirely, and over the next few days, the Bolsheviks argued bitterly amongst themselves. As Rabinowitz reports, we do not have any records or minutes of the meetings that took place between the 3rd and the 6th of November. But we do have first-hand accounts from after the fact, and piecing those together, it appears that after several deadlocked votes in the Central Committee about whether to approve the Tsikh position, essentially whether to adhere to a position of Soviet power and the program of the Second Congress, or whether these things could and should be sacrificed for the sake of coalition, Lenin was forced to appeal to the Petersburg Committee for support. The Petersburg Committee was, as it almost always was, much more militant and in the Leninist camp of the party. That is to say, they rejected coalition with the socialist in name, petty bourgeois in action parties, and even were disinclined to continue the Vikzhel talks. In fact, the Petersburg Committee endorsed the Tsikh ultimatum without too much trouble. When Lenin called on them for support in the Central Committee, they then sent a couple of representatives to endorse Lenin's position in the hopes of getting that position over the hump. But it appears Lenin was not the only one to appeal to forces outside the Central Committee for help. There is no hard evidence for this, but it seems the right Bolsheviks appealed to the left SRs to support them. Despite their representatives in the Tsikh endorsing the new hardline position, the left SRs were not, as a party, entirely committed to said position. The left SRs began threatening to cut ties with the Bolsheviks if the position was not softened, and if the Bolsheviks did not become more flexible in their negotiations. Again, there is no hard evidence that the right Bolsheviks were involved in left SR affairs, but it is a widely accepted explanation for the subsequent left SR behavior. In the end, however, Lenin's position won out in the Central Committee and in the Tsikh, and so a new delegation from the Tsikh of the Bolsheviks Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Ryazanov, and the left SRs Karelin and Prochian, were sent to the Vikzhel talks, with its next session scheduled for the 3rd of November. As for the right socialists, the Mensheviks and right SRs, they still believed the agreement that had been made on the 31st of October, the same one now being rejected by the Bolsheviks in favor of a much more hardline approach, would still be a viable position for negotiations. This meant that the Right Socialists were in for a rude awakening. Ryazanov presented the new hardline position at the Vikzhel talks on the 3rd, and then the masses underscored the point themselves. A delegation of factory workers submitted a resolution to the talks in which these workers agreed to a socialist coalition government in theory, but endorsed many of the essential points of the new Bolshevik left SR hardline position. In essence, the Right Socialists were met on the 3rd of November not only with an abrupt about-face from the Bolsheviks and left SRs, but with direct proof that the working masses of Petrograd supported them. Faced with this new reality, the Right Socialists did exactly what you would expect them to do. They declared these new terms unacceptable and insisted on the old ones. Suffice it to say, the talks devolved from there. Meanwhile, the rift within the Bolshevik Party leadership was about to explode. Lenin was used to debate. He welcomed it, and as we have seen, he was on the losing side of debate plenty of times. So it was not that Lenin was mad at Kamenev, Zinoviev, Rykov, and Nagin for disagreeing with him. He was furious that they were bucking party discipline by continuing negotiations to form a compromised coalition government just days after the Central Committee had adopted a resolution not to do precisely that. For Kamenev and Zinoviev in particular, this was not their first time. Remember that after the Central Committee meeting on the 10th of October declaring the overthrow of the government as the order of the day for the party, these two went around to the workers and tried to stop the revolution from happening at all, right up to the very last minute. At this point, Lenin asked the Central Committee members not allied with the rightists to sign a statement demanding that the rightists be disciplined by the party and pledged not to continue negotiations for coalition. In response to this, the rightists resigned from the Central Committee. They wrote to Lenin that in doing so, they were allowing themselves a free hand to agitate amongst the masses for support of their position of compromise. Rabinowitz draws an interesting parallel here between the actions of the Right Bolsheviks in the Central Committee in early November and the actions of the Right Socialists at the Second Congress on the 25th of October. Both groups voluntarily left their respective bodies. Both groups apparently hoped that doing so would shock the Left Bolsheviks and the masses into working with them. But both the Right Socialists and the Right Bolsheviks were mistaken. And ultimately, they both only ceded totally the arena of ideological struggle to Lenin and his supporters, and probably would have been better served if they had stayed to duke it out in the Congress and the Central Committee, respectively. Oops. With the Right Bolsheviks now gone from party leadership, the Left Bolsheviks and their Left SR colleagues abandoned the Vikzhel talks altogether. Officially, the last meeting of these talks was on the 6th of November. But with only the Mensheviks and SRs in attendance, there was nothing to discuss, and the talks were officially postponed indefinitely. The Right Socialist parties, for their part, interpreted the exodus of the rightists from the Bolshevik Central Committee as a sign of the impending total disintegration of the Bolsheviks as a ruling party, and eagerly prepared to pick up the pieces once the implosion took place. But much to their chagrin, this did not happen. At meeting after meeting across Petrograd, the masses reaffirmed their support for the Leninist line of refusal to compromise on the principles of the Second Congress. Starting with a conference on the 4th of November of delegates from the various Bolshevik district committees, continuing through the first conference of female workers of Petrograd on the 5th of November, and even at a meeting of the Petrograd Trade Union Council on the 9th of November, the rank-and-file members of the Bolshevik Party and the workers of Petrograd repeatedly adopted resolutions supporting Lenin's hard line against compromise. This really speaks for itself. It reveals that the Right Bolsheviks, led by Kamenev, were, in the end, an isolated minority confined to the leadership of the party. The rank and file of both the party and the working masses was with Lenin. They did not want to give up what they had won at the end of October. Furthermore, they were buoyed by the victories over the counter-revolution, which we discussed last episode. by proving to themselves and the world that they not only were actually capable of knocking the bourgeoisie out of power, but also would not go down without a fight and actually could lay out their class enemies entirely when they tried to get back up, the masses understood one thing. There was no reason to compromise. They held all the cards. The Mensheviks and SRs might still have some sway outside of Petrograd and Moscow, but the Bolsheviks and the Soviets were armed with the decrees of the Second Congress and those issued by the Sovnarkom. It was very much an open question which of the two sides would garner more support in the end. As for the workers of Petrograd, they had given up so much throughout 1917. They had, for the first time in world history, dislodged the aristocracy and its bourgeois lackeys from the throne of power, and were proving capable of holding on to that power. Why should they compromise? For fear that they would not be able to govern? But why should they not be able to govern? They knew how to work the machines. They were confident they could set up a governing apparatus that would work for their purposes. In the end, any fear of self-governance and inclinations to needless compromise were holdovers from bourgeois liberalism. There was the idea that compromise in and of itself was good and right and necessary, without any consideration of the correlation of forces or what would be lost or given up in that compromise. This was coupled by an inherent distrust in the ability of the masses to run their own affairs. All of this might sound infuriatingly familiar to us in the 21st century, but to the working and soldiering masses of Petrograd in the late fall of 1917, these ideas made zero sense, and so had no truck with them. They rallied behind the leader that was willing to defend their interests, Vladimir Lenin, and his party, the Bolsheviks. So after 2 weeks of debates full of negotiations, denunciations, accusations, recriminations, and resignations, we are left with an exclusively Bolshevik Soviet of People's Commissars, or Sovnarkom, that is officially and wholly responsible to the Central Executive Committee, or CEK, of the Second Congress of Soviets of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies, made up of predominantly Bolsheviks, but also left SRs, United Socialist Democratic Internationalists, and the Menshevik Internationalists. Again, on paper, the Sovnarkom was subordinate to the CEK. In practice, however, the Sovnarkom acted quite independently of the CEK, issuing emergency decrees and orders without its approval. On the 2nd of November came the decree on the rights of the people of Russia to self-determination. On the 14th of November came the decree on workers' control. In late November and early December came decrees on the recall of elected deputies and officials, on the judiciary, and even a major overhaul of the divorce and family laws in Russia. The primary purpose of these decrees and orders was to institute as rapidly as possible a revolutionary program that was designed to widen popular support for the government, possibly even enough to preempt a civil war. This de facto independence that the Sovnarkom was practicing was a source of great consternation within the CEK. There were still right Bolsheviks, as well as the non-Bolshevik parties, that took the role designated to the CEK of overseeing the Sovnarkom very seriously, and they protested heavily not only the fact that the Sovnarkom was issuing decrees without even notifying the CEK beforehand, but that these decrees had been and continued to be of a very heavy-handed nature. For example, I mentioned last episode the decree on the press that imposed heavy censorship of the bourgeois newspapers. When this decree had been implemented in the final days of October, Petrograd and Moscow had been embroiled in threats to Soviet power, with the outcome uncertain. As soon as those threats were overcome, as early as the 4th of November, there were official calls in the CEK to repeal the decree and restore full freedom of the press to the bourgeois periodicals. The argument was that, now that the immediate military threat had passed, the decree was no longer needed, and its continued enforcement was a blemish on the revolution. The counter-argument was that it was still much too early to allow the enemies of Soviet power unrestricted press freedoms. The cadets, Mensheviks, right SRs, and Junkers were still openly hostile to Soviet power, And while the immediate military threats might have been dealt with, more were on the horizon. A Leninist in the Tsikh named Afanasyev introduced a resolution not only prohibiting the repeal of the decree on the press, but also endorsing all the decrees the Sovnarkom had adopted up to that point. This resolution was ultimately passed, although not without much bitter debate. The Right Bolsheviks at this point were beside themselves. They had been proven to be out of step with the masses and a minority in both the Bolshevik Party and the government. Faced with what they sincerely believed to be grave mistakes, the abandonment of coalition, inflexibility toward the right socialist parties, and now a curtailing of what they considered to be essential civil liberties, Nagin, Commissar of Commerce and Industry, announced the resignation from the Sovnarkom of Commissars Rykov, Milyutin, and Teodorovich, as well as himself. These resignations were a final straw of sorts. The denunciations of the Sovnarkom's rule by decree and of the left Bolsheviks' intransigence were bad, but they were ultimately only words. The action of resignation of the rightists from both the Bolshevik Central Committee and the Sovnarkom suddenly made it seem as if both the party and the government were plagued with dysfunction. This triggered a vote of confidence within the Tsikh concerning the Sovnarkom. If the Tsikh failed to vote confidence in the new Soviet government, the position of the Leninist hardline Bolsheviks would be significantly undermined. Much to Lenin's relief, however, the Tsikh voted, very narrowly it should be said, for confidence in the Sovnarkom. Thus, the new Soviet government and the Leninist position emerged from the Tsikh meeting on the 4th of November bruised, but intact. The commissar posts that had been vacated were filled relatively quickly. Nagin was replaced by Shliapnikov, who served as commissar of both labor and of commerce and industry for the next year. Rykov was replaced as commissar of the interior by Grigory Ivanovich Petrovsky, a Ukrainian Bolshevik, and Alexander Grigorievich Schlichter took over as both commissar of food and of agriculture, replacing Teodorovich and Milyutin, respectively. And in case you are worried, no, I do not plan on keeping up with every single new commissar for the next 75 years. I just did not want to leave any gaps this early in the game, as it were. After this, the defiance of the Central Committee position in the Vikzhel talks, the resignations from the Central Committee and the Sovnarkom, and the bucking of party discipline, Lenin was pretty fed up with Kamenev and his crew. He threatened to have Kamenev, Ryazanov, Larin, and Zinoviev expelled from the party altogether if they did not stop undermining the Central Committee. He also moved to have Kamenev removed as chairman of the Tsikh and the leader of the Bolshevik faction. On the 8th of November, a meeting of the Bolshevik Central Committee voted to remove Kamenev from his position in the Tsikh. He was replaced with Yakov Sverdlov, director of the party secretariat and a committed Leninist. Some have argued that under Sverdlov's leadership, the Tsikh became just a rubber stamp for Lenin, as he was still the chair of the Sovnarkom. But it could just as easily be argued that, after the defeat of the Right Bolsheviks, the government in the executive of the Sovnarkom and the legislature of the Tsikh were operating on the same page. It is not as if the Tsikh had no oversight or control over the Sovnarkom, or that there was never any debate about anything. But the left Bolsheviks, the majority of the party, supported by the masses, had successfully consolidated power, and their position was endorsed by the other parties in the Tsikh, and so the government was simply more unified from this point on. Having Lenin as the chairman of the Sovnarkom, with a Leninist as chairman of the Tsikh, is no more a rubber stamp than is having a Democrat in the White House and a Democrat as Speaker of the House. At least with the Leninists, the working masses are not getting screwed from all angles. Oh, and despite all this drama we have been dishing out all episode, do not worry. Just about everyone who resigned or was threatened with expulsion eventually returned to positions of leadership in the government and the Bolshevik Party. Although in most cases, not the exact same positions, because, as we have seen, these vacancies were filled as quickly as possible to keep things moving. In these early days, Tempers were running high, patience was in short supply, probably because everyone spent every single night yelling at each other in debate halls at all the different midnight meetings, and egos were bruised. But after the dust settled, everyone made up and got back to the business at hand, building a revolutionary workers' state. Something I want to address that occurred to me in my research for this episode is the collapse of the Vic Shell talks. Specifically, what did not happen after the talks were ended. What did not happen was the strike, which had been threatened just a week earlier. The question I have is, why, after demanding a broad coalition of socialist parties, was there no strike after this coalition failed to materialize? Was Vic Shell bluffing, or is there some other explanation? And I mean, maybe the strike was a bluff. Like I said, the rank and file of the union was not in lockstep with its leadership. Would they have actually gone on strike if one had been declared? Or would we have seen a crisis in the union between the leadership and rank and file? We will never know, and I am not going to argue that this would have happened. But I do not think that such an outcome would have been completely impossible. Despite how much of a danger to the new Soviet government a threat of a strike was, we do not know how real that threat itself was. There is no reason to believe the Vic Shell leadership was not serious about declaring the strike. But there are at least some reasons to doubt a strike would have actually taken place had the rank and file of the union been called to one. But beyond that, I think the reason a strike was not called after the collapse of the talks on the 6th of November is because the situation had become much clearer over the preceding week. Vic Shell had openly declared that they wanted a coalition specifically in order to end the bloodshed and fighting in Petrograd and Moscow. By the 6th of November, the fighting had already ended, with the Soviet forces victorious. They had also been wary of perceived Bolshevik intransigence and refusal to compromise. While there had been an abrupt 180 during the course of the talks, at no point had the Bolsheviks been categorically opposed to compromise and coalition. They had instead ultimately insisted on principled compromise. The Bolsheviks and left SRs had a red line they would not cross, the program of the Second Congress. And this was backed up by vociferous support from the working masses in Petrograd. The Mensheviks and right SRs, on the other hand, despite the change in their military fortunes in early November and the popular support the Bolsheviks and new Soviet power had, still rejected out of hand the principled compromise that had been proposed to them. And so, in a way, they were the intransigent ones. And Vic Shell could see this by the end. With the fighting over and the surprise plot twist that the right socialists were now the villains, a strike against an obviously popular government just did not make sense. Anyway, these are my own thoughts on the matter. None of the sources I am using even pose this question, let alone try to answer it. It is just something that occurred to me, and as I thought about it, I realized the answer I was coming up with touched on the major themes of the episode. The failure of the right Bolsheviks is best understood as the defeat of a minority that was disconnected from mass sentiment. It was not, as is sometimes portrayed, Lenin mercilessly crushing his enemies. It was, instead, Lenin yet again being almost flawlessly in tune with the masses he was leading. In the end, had the right Bolsheviks prevailed, the program of the Second Congress would have been under threat, and the masses would either have revolted or become alienated from the Bolshevik Party as a whole. This yet again underscores the importance of the connection of the vanguard party with the masses that is a central tenet of Leninism. Those who do not maintain this connection are doomed to failure. I want to close out this episode with those thoughts of mine on the four decrees I have attached as supplementals. I had toyed with the idea of including the Declaration of Rights of Nationalities, but since we have a dedicated episode on the nationalities question coming up, I am going to save that one. The significance of the decrees on peace and land to the revolution cannot be overstated. As we saw, they were incredibly popular and were a rallying point for the masses, inspiring them to come out in ardent support of the new government. The peace decree was one of the most uncontroversial decrees that came out of the Congress and of this period generally. The people wanted the war to end, and Lenin and the Bolsheviks issued a very blunt call for an immediate end to the fighting. The terms they proposed for peace were entirely disagreeable to the capitalists and imperialists, but I think that kind of tells you everything you need to know about the decree, the nature of the war, and on whose side the Bolsheviks were. As for the land decree, it was basically a slightly tweaked version of the SR land program, which that party had been promoting all year. Remember from episode 7, The Party and the People, that Lenin actually disagreed with this program. The SRs had wanted to socialize the land, turning it over to local community ownership under the control of peasants' committees. Lenin had wanted to nationalize the land, that is, make everything the property of the state, with administration run by the Soviets. But the simple truth was, Lenin adopted the SR land program because he recognized that it was the most popular program available. Lenin defended the decision by saying that the new democratic Soviet government had a responsibility to the sentiments of the masses, even if the leaders of the government did not agree with them. The problem with the SR program had not been that it was unpopular. It had been that, despite its overwhelming popularity, the SRs had refused to implement it. But hey, since the SRs were not using the program, they certainly would not mind Lenin and the Bolsheviks borrowing it, right? When later on, right SRs accused Lenin of what today would amount to IP theft, Lenin responded coolly, quote, "We can say thank you. That is all you can expect from us," end quote. The decree on the press was, at the time, one of the most controversial decrees made by the new government, as we have already discussed. And I'm going to put my to-be-fair hat on for a moment and say, I can see why. The most prevalent criticism of this decree is that it, in effect, made Lenin and his government the sole arbiters of what kind of speech was legal. In a narrow sense, that is true. Although I would also point out that the decree limited the ban on the press to those periodicals which, quote, "incite to open resistance or disobedience toward the workers' and peasants' government, or sow confusion by way of clearly slanderous distortion of the facts, or incite clearly criminal actions," end quote. I know the devil is in the details of what counts as open resistance and slanderous distortion of the facts, but even so, this is a far cry from banning all criticism of the government outright. Even today, in the United States and elsewhere, spreading slanderous rumors and openly calling for the overthrow of the government is going to get you banned, arrested, or imprisoned. But there are several paragraphs before this section where Lenin explains why and to what ends this ban was introduced. Lenin was not wrong that the bourgeois press in Petrograd at the time was spreading vicious and unsubstantiated rumors. He also was not wrong that the press was one of the most vital and important civil institutions in Russian society. Mass media in general, and who controls it, is one of the most critical questions in any society, and the bourgeois playbook of flooding the media with false stories and unsubstantiated rumors presented as fact specifically in order to undermine a government or project they do not like, is one which has been run thousands of times in the 20th and 21st centuries, all over the world. There was even an entire not very good James Bond movie with a villain trying to control the world through mass media. At the time, the plot seemed ridiculous, but now, in the age of Twitter and Facebook and cable news, it was chillingly prescient. In the unstable situation of Petrograd and Russia in the fall of 1917, with a new proletarian state emerging for the first time ever, the bourgeoisie absolutely had as one of its goals to undermine the entire project. And the press was absolutely one of the ways in which they were cautiously attempting to achieve this goal. I think it is impossible to disagree with Lenin's analysis of the situation, and his conclusion that something had to be done about the problem, even if one disagrees with the solution he eventually landed on. And finally, we have the decree on worker control. This one was published mid-November, so several weeks after the drama we discussed here. The final published decree was a synthesis of several other proposals that had been submitted by various groups to various committees. All I can say about it for now is that it was an ambitious and revolutionary approach to the organization of economic production. I am sure many of you are already aware that within less than a year, some of what was laid out in this decree will be walked back or abandoned altogether. We will discuss the details of why once we get there, but by way of sneak peek, I will say that this decree, while awesome on paper, did not work out so well in practice, and many of the changes that certain people like to point to as evidence of the counter-revolutionary nature of the Bolsheviks and their state were enacted at the request of the workers themselves. I'll bet you didn't see that coming, did you? As I mentioned at the start, the story told here is only half the story of the formation of a new Soviet government. It is an important story, with crucial victories for the proletariat of Petrograd, which enabled them to lead the charge for Soviet power across the rest of the country. The importance of the program of the Second Congress in rallying the masses to the Bolshevik Party and the Soviets, especially once the fighting starts, cannot be understated. And I hope you listen to the supplementals. The various decrees are radical, inspirational, and frankly, still largely relevant to us today. Even knowing now that these decrees were not the final word in these affairs, and knowing that in some ways the Soviet government would ultimately fall short of the noble aspirations contained in these and other decrees, I would hope that, for now, you all can just enjoy the fact that these decrees were adopted and successfully defended by the masses, and that they represented a giant step forward for the peoples of the former Russian Empire. We need to take the wins when we have them. Next time, we will complete this story of the formation of the new Soviet government and turn to the peasant question. We will explore Lenin's attitude to the peasants in general, and then go through the merging of the Soviets of workers' and soldiers' deputies with the Soviets of the peasants' deputies to create a government truly representative of the toiling masses of Russia, the first of its kind in human history. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars: Big Easy H, Bryce Holder, Cage 433, Kat Brannigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathenes, Jay, Jack, Josue Ponce, Nicodemus, Rasmussen Svensson, Ryan Fowler, Sam McGeever, and Zach Wheatley. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.